Show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and it is cussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Looky here, it's the 19th day of July 2013. We are live from Capitol Hill, the headquarters of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign, the 8th campaign. It is still sticky, nasty, hot outside. And I'll be honest, I just told Sparky in the chat room. Have you been to the chat room, the headonradionetwork.com chat room? It's free and it's easy and you're always welcome there. Crowd's not... crowd hasn't filtered in quite yet, so you can be among the first if you wish. Right now, it's just me and Sparky. I told Sparky earlier today that I've been battling the urge for an ice cold malted fermented beverage for about 4 hours now. I mean, and it's not, you know, it's not the, you know, oh Jesus, pink elephants kind of thing. It's the, you know, it's really hot and this is why beer exists kind of thing. But I made a promise to you a very, very long time ago that unlike right-wing radio, I would never get behind the microphone half in the bag, whether the bag be a bag of OxyContin like our buddy Rush Limbaugh or, you know, whatever former addiction it is that makes bats fly around in the Beckerhead's little noggin. I just won't do that. And so we find ourselves together for this little conversation this evening. Jug of Punch has wandered into the room. Hey, Jug. And thank you for your offer of kind confidentiality, Sparky. He said, I won't tell if you have one. Oh, you know, this town has a lot of tables sitting out on sidewalks. You know, it was D.C. was designed as a sort of imitation Paris by Pierre L'Enfant. And consequently, there's a lot of sidewalk cafes and well, it would be nice, I must admit, it would be nice. But no, not going to happen. Work to be done. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. This really is the horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you'll find the listen live button for listening to the stream. A little note based on something Agnes told me, however. That is a Windows Media Player listen live button, so you're going to have to get the stream conventionally if you listen to via something like, well, you know, iTunes or whatnot. But you know what? There are great media players out there. iTunes isn't one of them. And that's not an Apple thing. That's just iTunes is probably the single most clunky media player I think I've ever run across. I'm not crazy about Windows Media Player myself. A lot of times I use Winamp. But never mind. Any way you choose to get the program is fine. And of course you can always get it on your streaming smart devices now. We highly recommend TuneIn, the TuneIn radio app. We also recommend Stitcher. What's wrong with the sound? Oh, no. 6:02 p.m., Sparky, sounding good, Bob. 6:04 p.m., Texas Betsy, what's with the sound? Not again. Not again. Well, somebody answer, please. Or I'm just going to keep on talking. Okay, thank you, Sparky. Thank you, Juckapunch. No, I don't think anything's hiccuping. Agnes says all sounds good there. Restart your player, Betsy. There's a lot of good ways to get the program. And, of course, the podcast address is at whiterosesociety.org under the subdomain for this program, and you can also get the podcast for free at iTunes. Now, a gentle reminder as we begin this Friday on the front porch, and, oh, brother, it's Friday on the front porch, we keep all of this going by virtue of your kind contributions. We pulled up a little bit short yesterday. We pulled up about $60 short, so we find ourselves needing to raise this evening $210 just to finish the week in the to the good. And if we can do that, that would be wonderful. It means we can start fresh on Monday when Monday rolls around. So the PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com, as you know. And you can also find there the traditional mail address, which I'll repeat now. It's The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, Beckley, WV 25801. And Boss Man Wayne just loves it when he opens the mailbox and is greeted by something besides an echo. And there have been a lot of echoes lately, but we're trundling along, and hopefully we'll find that $210 out there. 21 folks at $10, 42 at $5, 11 and a half at 20. Oh, well, you know, math. Room's filling up for this Friday on the front porch, and been a long day of correspondence writing, trying to get meetings. We're working the Senate side right now. And, of course, you understand that you yourself are a vital portion, a vital part. You play a vital role in helping us end the Appalachian apocalypse and helping us bring some surcease of sorrow born of mountaintop removal. And that means you get busy with your members of the Senate. We need your calls. Are you in California? Call Feinstein. Call Senator Boxer. Are you in Oregon? Call Senator Wyden. Call Senator Merkley. Are you in Washington? Call Senator Cantwell. And why can't I remember the other senator from Washington? Well, it's a live program and everything's not scripted, so you'll have that. But there are opportunities. Are you in Colorado? Call Senator Udall. Call Senator, other Colorado senator whose name I can't remember. I'm sorry. Ah, yeah, Patty Murray. Of course. Thank you, Sparky. Patty Murray in Washington. We can get this done, but we have got to teach the members of the Senate that Appalachian people are not little mythological. Hillbillies aren't little mythological creatures like hobbits and leprechauns and, you know, garden gnomes. We're real-life human beings, and actually Americans who deserve not to be poisoned to death just because we happen to live next to where some profiteers live. Well, they don't live there. They just blast the hell out of it and send the poisons down on top of us. That's what they do. But we need you. And in order to, if you want to, I highly suggest that the best way, I remind you, the best way to go about educating yourself on the crisis in Appalachia, the human rights crisis in Appalachia, is to go to ACHEACT.org, ACHEACT.org. Go there and learn. You can read all the most of the peer-reviewed scientific articles. More will be coming, and we add them when they do arrive. Read them, and then draw the attention of your members of the Senate to them. Because as long as mountaintop removal continues, neither I, nor my lovely wife, nor our children, whom we dearly love and whom some of you have heard from over the years behind the microphone, nor any of our friends or neighbors or colleagues, well, we're not really fully human and we're not fully American, as long as 5.5 million pounds of high explosives are going off around us and the toxic, ultra-fine particulated dust is finding its way into our lungs and into our various systems, you know, cancer-causing dust. All right. So there's that. And if you'll take action, well, if you don't take action, it's going to be hard to get anything done. If you do take action, we've got a puncher's chance of a real future in Appalachia. Thanks, everybody, for letting me know that sounds good. Thanks, Jack in Shreveport. Thanks, Robert in Australia. Thanks, Randy in PA. Goodness me. Yeah, I had a note. I was going to go straight to it. I had a note from Robert in Australia. That's one of the lovely things about podcasting is that with podcasting, you can carry on a conversation past the frame of the immediate show itself. So toward the end of the program last night, I brought up the story of what's going on in Deer Trail, Colorado, where they're putting a bounty on drones. No, really. You remember. They're going to sell drone hunting licenses, and you got to shoot at the drones with shotguns. No bigger or no smaller than a 12. You can't be shooting no 410, I don't reckon. You got to at least use a 12-gauge. Now, I don't know if you can use a slug or a pumpkin ball or if there's any shot size, but no, you got to use a shotgun. So Robert in Australia heard the podcast, and he said, drone hunting in Deer Trail. First thing that popped into my head, Robert said, was, at what altitude do drones fly? A quick check of Wikipedia resulted in handheld 2,000 feet, 600-meter altitude, about 2-kilometer range, close 5,000 feet altitude, up to 10 kilometers range. NATO-type drones fly at 10,000 feet altitude, up to 50-kilometer range. A tactical drone flies at 18,000 feet altitude, about 160 kilometers range. Do you see the development of a trend here? The male medium-altitude long-endurance drone, yes, it's called male, up to 30,000 feet, that's 9,000 meters, and has a range over 200 kilometers. The HALE, the high-altitude long-endurance, flies over 30,000 feet and has an indefinite range. The hypersonic, there are hypersonic drones, who knew? Well, Wikipedia did. High-speed supersonic Mach 1 to 5 or hypersonic Mach 5 plus at 50,000 feet or suborbital attitude with a range of over 200 kilometers. And then there's your orbital in the low Earth orbit drone at Mach 25 plus. Robert also sends along a photograph that says, as you can see, sizes vary. Which reminds me of the disclaimer on all the commercials, of course. Your results may vary. I remember when Reverbo brought that concept up with regard to the Constitution of the United States. Your results may vary. Trying to vote in America? Your results may vary. So Robert continues to say, now, Bob, I don't know anything at all about guns. I've never even held a real one, let alone fired it. So perhaps you could fill in the blanks for me. Could someone with a commercially available shotgun, as described in your program, actually shoot down a drone flying at 600 meters? My immediate guess, Robert, is no. But you got to understand, you're working with teabagger brains here. A shotgun is an all-purpose Second Amendment Constitution defending liberty guaranteeing tool. Right? Robert says, me, I want to see the folks at Deer Trail take out one of those low Earth orbit models. Oh, no, let's don't say that. Or then it'll be like that poor guy in Germany who got a visit from the federal police and called him a smart aleck for wearing his Team Snowden, Team Ed t-shirt or whatever it was. And then again, I mean, there's some good shots out. I mean, there really are some excellent, excellent shooters in the United States. We have a gun-crazy culture that has yielded up some real marksmanship. You know, if you've ever seen Gary Cooper in Sergeant York, you know, I like to lick the front sight of cuts down on the haze. Right? And he does a turkey call and starts picking off Germans in the trenches in the Great War. But still, what does that thing fly at? Yeah, Mach 25 plus. I mean, there's the concept of sun, you got to lead them a little bit, but and that's pretty good for duck and goose. I don't know how that works at suborbital. So, no, these are highly unintelligent teabagger types who are out there defending freedom, Wolverines! And they're going to hunt them some drones and get a bounty and take up arms against the United States government, or it could be one of them baby blue drones from the UN after they get done invading Lubbock. Paranoia will destroy you. But this also in from Robert. It is the 19th of the month here, but there in Australia, it is the 20th of the month. And Robert notes, it's the 20th of July here, so it's time for the 20th of the month Down Under Challenge. It's $50 this month. Lots of bills came due this month, and it's 44 years since the first moon landing, which did happen. Robert emphasizes that. It did happen. I know, because I was sitting there, little six-year-old that I was, and watched it happen. Did you know that that one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind line was actually botched? Bless his heart, Neil Armstrong went up on his lines. But that's still pretty elegant, isn't it? Yeah, so let's take a minute and remember the moon landing and where we could have been had we stayed on track. Had Nixon not... Well, Henry, the people just aren't as interested in the moon landings as they used to be. It's become ordinary for them. We need something bigger, like a bombing in Laos or something. Can you work something out, Henry? So thank you very kindly, Robert, for putting that $50 challenge on the table. Hopefully that will make it manifestly easier for us to reach tonight's fundraising goal, $210. Robert's got 50 of that. If somebody else or some other group of people come up with the other 50, and it is a tremendous help. Thank you very much, Robert. So we get a sense. We get a sense, the PayPal button's at headonradionetwork.com, you know that. We get a little sense, beginning with Deer Trail, Colorado, of where it is and just sort of what sort of Friday on the front porch it may turn out to be. Of course, the entire right-wing sphere is losing its collective cookies because of that one who lives in our White House said something about race today. Bless his heart, President Obama just said that he spoke the obvious. He said, 35 years ago, I could have been Trayvon Martin. Well, it's the truth. President Obama showed up at the daily White House press briefing now that it is apparently safe for him to do so since the Daily Caller's 16-year-old intern, what was his name, Ezekiel Goldfinger or whatever. But he showed up, well... Here, let's see if the audio actually works. This is always a dice roll.
Well, I want to come out here, first of all, to tell you that Jay is prepared for all your questions and is very much looking forward to the session. Second thing is I want to let you know that over the next couple of weeks, there are going to obviously be a whole range of issues, immigration, economics, et cetera. We'll try to arrange a fuller press conference to address your questions. The reason I actually wanted to come out today is not to take questions, but to speak to an issue that obviously has gotten a lot of attention over the course of the last week, the issue of the Trayvon Martin ruling. I gave a preliminary statement.
With all due respect, can I point something out here? It wasn't the Trayvon Martin ruling. It was the George Zimmerman verdict. Trayvon Martin got his ruling in February of 2012. It was delivered by George Zimmerman in the form of, I believe, a 9mm caliber handgun projectile fired point blank into Trayvon Martin's chest. That was the Trayvon Martin ruling. Not that I'm splitting hairs with the President of the United States or anything, but just want to keep things sort of tidy.
Right after the ruling on Sunday, watching the debate over the course of the last week, I thought it might be useful for me to expand on my thoughts a little bit. First of all, I want to make sure that, once again, I send my thoughts and prayers as well as Michelle's to the family of Trayvon Martin. And to remark...
Well, that's mistake number one, isn't it? Not by me. Not by you. But according to the mouth-breathing, knuckle-walking, floor-rolling, strychnine-drinking, Gadsden flag-waving, tri-cornered hat-wearing, tea-bag freaks out there, that's a mistake. Well, why couldn't he send any thoughts out to George Zimmerman's family? I guess they really are on their own, like that young 16-year-old heroic intern from the Daily Caller, Ezekiel Goldfinger, said the other day. They really are on their own, aren't they? Because, see, that there Obama, he ain't got no sympathies for poor old George Zimmerman, what had to put two Band-Aids on his head for all the damage what Trayvon done did to him. You think I'm kidding, don't you? We're going to find out in a minute that I'm not.
On the incredible grace and dignity with which they dealt with the entire situation. I can only imagine what they're going through, and it's remarkable how they've handled it. The second thing I want to say is to reiterate what I said on Sunday, which is there are going to be a lot of arguments about the legal issues in the case. I'll let all the legal analysts and talking heads addressed those issues. The judge conducted the trial in a professional manner. The prosecution and the defense made their arguments. The juries were properly instructed.
Please don't say the system works. Please don't say the system works. Please don't say the system works.
That... In a case such as this, reasonable doubt was relevant, and they rendered a verdict. And once the jury's spoken, that's how our system works.
No, oh, he said the system works. Oh, it hurts, it hurts. Because, see, the system didn't work. Because the system was set up from the very beginning in such a way that it allowed a cop wannabe like George Zimmerman to stalk and slaughter Trayvon Martin. That's not a system that works unless it's a murder system. Just saying. But anyway, please continue, Mr. President.
But I did want to just talk a little bit about context and how people have responded to
context
it
is good.
How people are feeling. You know, when Trayvon Martin was first shot, I said that this could have been my son. Another way of saying that is...
Now, can I point out something here real quick? President Obama is not screaming. He's not pounding either fist or shoe upon the podium. He is speaking in his usual measured, largely dispassionate tones. There are no angry cries in the background. I just wanted to point that out before we have to get to the other stuff.
Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago.
And it's true. There is not a person of color in this country who has not at some point in time or another been looked askance at, been followed, been queried, been profiled. None. None. And here's a hint. If you're white folks and you say you don't understand, well, that's the beginning of wisdom, because you don't, because no white folks really can. But if, on the other hand, you profess to say that things are other than as they are, well, that's just, you know, your white privilege is beginning to glow in the dark a little bit.
And when you think about why, in the African-American community at least, there's a lot of pain around what happened here. I think it's important to recognize that the African-American community is looking at this issue through a set of experiences and a history that that doesn't go away. There are very few African-American men in this country who haven't had the experience of being followed when they were shopping in a department store. That includes me. There are very, very few African-American men who haven't had the experience of walking across the street and hearing the locks click on the doors of cars. That happens to me, at least before I was a senator. There are very few African-Americans who haven't had the experience of getting on an elevator and a woman clutching her purse nervously and holding her breath until she had a chance to get off. That happens often. And I don't want to exaggerate this, but those sets of experiences inform how the African-American community interprets what happened one night in Florida. And it's inescapable for people to bring those experiences to bear. The African-American community is also knowledgeable that there is a history of racial disparities in the application of our criminal laws. Everything from the death penalty to enforcement of our drug laws.
Or the prison industrial complex, right? Yeah. Or the, for instance, the school to prison pipeline that they run down in Mississippi Stan, right?
And that ends up having an impact in terms of how people interpret the case. Now, this isn't to say that the African American community is naive about the fact that African-American young men are disproportionately involved in the criminal justice system, that they're disproportionately both victims and perpetrators of violence. It's not to make excuses for that fact, although black folks do interpret the reasons for that in a historical context. They understand that some of the violence that takes place in poor black neighborhoods around the country is born out of a very violent past in this country.
Now, you and I are listening to this, and I'll guarantee you that there is some significant percentage of the Horn family commune who are saying to themselves, well, yeah, but, and not saying, well, yeah, but in terms of he's wrong, but golly Moses, I wish he would say it in more forceful terms. But that's not how Teabag America and Confederate America and paranoid, terrified white folks America and Second Amendment America hears these words. You've got a pretty good idea there of the tenor of these remarks. And it seems that these are off the cuff. So that tells me that President Obama made these remarks, I don't know, does this sound like the product of a cabinet meeting? Because, you know, you can spot generally committee speak from a mile away because they've got, they're loaded with weasel words. This seems to be real. Now, we will leave aside for the moment previous instances of blaxplaining. And listen, as a white guy, I've probably got no business even trying to define anything like that. But it seems to be coming from a real place. Ultimately, in his remarks, President Obama said, if Trayvon Martin, and I think it's a fair question, it's a hypothetical, but it is a realistic hypothetical. If Trayvon Martin was of age and armed, could he have stood his ground on that sidewalk? And, of course, the answer is no. Had the roles been reversed, the Sanford police would have shown up, and Trayvon Martin would have been just as dead. Or at the very least, on trial for his life on a charge of capital murder. Because that's how things still work in old Confederate Florida. He went so far, President Obama did, as to ask whether Trayvon Martin would have been justified in shooting Mr. Zimmerman, who had followed him in a car, because Martin felt threatened. Trayvon Martin felt threatened. And the upshot of all of this was to suggest that maybe, just maybe, just maybe, we ought to rethink these stand your ground laws. Because these stand your ground laws were generated by the American Legislative Exchange Council with the connivance of the National Republican Rifle Association. And they weren't, and there was nothing, and they're not, they are not race neutral. They are designed for paranoid, terrified, trigger-happy white folks who own the vast majority of the firearms in this country in the first place. So with that understanding, then, let us consider the right-wing response to those incredibly mild-mannered remarks. And I don't think there's anything to call them but mild-mannered remarks. I mean, it certainly isn't up against the wall revolutionary. No, it was mild. Marty pointing out, he said, I thought President Not Sure said that's how the system works. Not the system works. Big difference in meaning, at least to me. Yeah, there's some nuance there, but there's a presumption there that there's a working system, too. And, well, I just don't think it does. Cassie writing in from Princeton. I actually will be at the White House in August. I'm no longer 16, and I doubt I'll even see the president, much less have a chance to ask him a question. She's going there, by the way, our Cassie, for futureofchildren.org, which is a joint effort of Princeton University and the Brookings Institute, providing research and analysis to promote effective policies and programs for children. And, of course, that is right in Cassie's wheelhouse. She's liable to anything to do with that. She's probably going to, oh, it's going to look like a grapefruit floating over the plate, and it's going to sail right out of the park. Good work, Cassie. Ron and Raleigh writing, hey, Bob, I had some martial arts training in my youth. I don't think people have any clue how much it takes to kill someone with your bare hands or the level of rage one has to be possessed of to do that kind of damage if not trained. George Zimmerman allegedly took MMA training, mixed martial arts, several times a week, yet he was losing a fist fight to a kid 50 pounds lighter and 12 years younger. Woe to a 17-year-old that would have picked a fight with me when I was 29 years old. George Zimmerman is a proven liar. The jury chose to believe those lies. Just like they chose to believe defense counsel when defense counsel started talking about weaponized concrete. Oh, please. If someone takes you by the head and slams your head into a concrete sidewalk once, you're going to need more than two stinking Band-Aids. Good observation, Ron. Thank you. So now we go into the right-wing swamp. You've heard with your own ears. You have heard what Barack Obama said today. 35 years ago, I could have been Trayvon Martin. And you see, the killing of Trayvon Martin has an element, so I am told, of there but for the grace of God go I. For just about every African-American male that I have spoken to, corresponded with during the course of this discussion, ongoing as it has been. It's a reality. This is a country that was born out of a cauldron of racial sewage. This is a country that calculated in its founding operational document people of dark skin as 3/5 of a human being. And yet did not confer upon them 3/5 of the rights of one. And who used that 3/5 as, you know, they see this, when the Constitution was being written, the Southern planters were in a spot. Because the House of Representatives was designed to have proportional representation based upon population, and they wanted their slave population to be counted, just not as human beings. But if they had not been counted at all, then the House of Representatives would have been absolutely dominated by the North, and slavery would have gone the way of the dodo, but the dodo went the way of the dodo. And so the solution that was agreed upon wound up being bad for the North and bad for the South and worse for the people who were being legalistically abused in the framing of the document. But still, President Obama's remarks were measured and mild and real. Necessarily, then, Todd Starnes of Radio Rwanda, Fox News, tweeted, "Obama's comments today justify what I said on Hannity earlier this week. He truly is trying to tear our country apart." No, our country's doing quite a good enough job of that as it is, and especially the House of Representatives and its majority. Coming to some sort of reconciliation with our racist and terrifying past is actually the only hope this nation has. Acknowledging the past and acknowledging what yet remains in the present and how to keep it from metastasizing into the future. Truly is trying to tear our country apart. Only if by tear the country apart you mean get white folks to confront some of the realities that a significant portion of this country deals with on a daily basis. Then there's Dan Reel, who is described as an influential conservative blogger. "If you ever have any doubts, Obama is the first racist in chief." Yeah, because, you know, he called for lynch mobs and night riders to go and drag white folks out of their homes in the middle of the night. And sure, picnic baskets under big trees. You get the idea. Yeah, he did that. Not. And then over at that website that rhymes with night fart, They've got a failed journalism student by the name of Ben Shapiro, who today tweeted, "Obama helped ignite this ginned-up racial melee." Melee where? That's the thing. There haven't been any daggum melees. There have been a few isolated incidents, but no melees. This is not the same thing as the aftermath of the Rodney King verdict. But the right wing sure would like for it to be, so they could get in and do some melee-in of their own. Obama helped ignite this ginned-up racial melee by saying his son would look like Trayvon. Now he says he could have been Trayvon. Problem there, Ben, is that both statements are true. The only untruth in your little tweet is that there's a racial melee, or that it was ginned up. Ben, it wasn't ginned up. If there is a melee, it was gunned up by George Zimmerman. Just say it. Then there's Tammy Bruce. God, I heard her voice one time, and it sounded, I don't know, it sounded like canaries being killed. So Obama could have been Trayvon 35 years ago? I had no idea. Obama sucker punched a watch volunteer and then bashed his head in. Who knew? Well, no one knows, Tam, because the watch volunteer didn't get his head bashed in. He had a boo-boo that required two Band-Aids. Then there's Dana Loesch. Lesh? Leash? Blouse? Not sure. Don't know the pronunciation. We'll call her Jones. It's a combo protest diversion from scandals and attempt to weaken laws protecting right to self-defense. Wrong. See, there's something at work here, and of course Dana being dumber than dried dirt top of a fence post wouldn't know this, but the right to self-defense is a function not of statute. It goes way, way, way back. You know, Sherman set the way back machine for Runnymede, kind of way back, and is enshrined in the common law of Merry Oldie Engelon that was sort of carried over and adopted here. Stand your ground is not a self-defense law. Stand your ground is an offensive law. Yes, it is offensive, as in, offensive. But it is an offensive law, not a defensive law. Stand your ground laws say that you, if you're packing heat and somebody looks at you cross-eyed and puts you in fear, you can blow them to Jesus. It really means that. And that's what happened when the decision was rendered, to use the language, on Trayvon Martin in February 2012. Oh, look, here's former Representative Joe Walsh of Illinois and deadbeat dad. President Obama making this all about race, all dot about dot race dot. Well, what is it? What else is it about? It isn't about self-defense. We could certainly say that it is about a failed law enforcement system, about a police department that botched the investigation before there was almost from the get-go. The circuit clerk's office delivered all the items of evidence, personal belongings of Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman, back to the Sanford Police Department in the last day or so, and they were getting ready to dole it back out to the people to whom it belonged, including the firearm. They were getting ready to put a pistol, literally a pistol with the blood of a human being in it and on it, back into the hands of George Zimmerman, but for the fact that at the last moment the Department of Justice did say, you know what, we're charging you with protecting all of that evidence and doing nothing with it because we still have an investigation that is ongoing. One can only hope And if one is of the praying sort, one may pray that there will be some measure of justice out of the Department of Justice for the manifest violation of civil rights, because having your life unjustifiably taken from you is a violation of civil rights. For Trayvon Martin. Now we go back over to that website that rhymes with night fart. Joel Pollack. Pollack. Obama backs the race baiters on the eve of Sharpton Palooza. Identity public politics above all shameful. Hashtag Zimmerman. Hashtag Trayvon. Hashtag could have been me. And just a moment with that could have been me thing, real quick. The president may have actually been using the wrong verb tense. Okay, is it Pollack? Okay, thank you, Texas Betsy. Thank you. P-O-L-L-A-K, Pollack. He's another failed journalist wannabe from over at Night Fart. But just a quick observation. It's not just that Trayvon Martin could have been Barack Obama 35 years ago. Barack Obama could be Trayvon Martin any day of the week since January the 20th, 2009. Never in the history of the presidency has the Secret Service had to act on more death threats, on more homicidal impulses, on more murderous urges than they have with regard to white folks out there losing what's left of their itsy bitsy teensy tiny microscopic little minds over the fact that that one's in our White House. Wasn't it just last night that we were talking about the shirtless dude wandering around in Lafayette Park with his shooting iron gun sticking out of the waistband of his blue jeans, and he had two clips with him and 170 rounds of ammunition and a knife, and he said, "I was just going to squeeze off a couple of rounds. I wasn't going to hurt nobody unless somebody confronted me." So it's not just could have. And I'm not, I hope the Secret Service is doing a good job. This country does not deal well with those sorts of incidents, and I'm sort of a man of peace in the first place anyway, so I hope you guys are doing a good job, because it's not could have been me, it's might yet be him. How many of these cases have there been? Remember what was it, West Memphis, Arkansas, where the guys got popped several years ago because they were going to start some sort of a thing that was going to, and then there were the militia people in Michigan who were trying to start, we need a race war to cleanse this nation for Jesus. Those types. Then there's so-called Republican strategist Brian Walsh, who said, "Remarkable that the President of the United States continues to fan the flames on George Zimmerman." There are no flames! I don't understand these flames that you're talking about, Sheldon. There are no flames. This has thus far been about as reasoned a response to a manifest injustice as this country could ever have expected. Hashtag, by the way, stop talking, sir. That's right, Brian Walsh. Tell the dark-skinned guy to be quiet. Yeah, no white privilege there. And apparently there's a think tank called the Right Sphere, and they've got a senior feller who calls himself R.B. Pundit. I don't get out enough. Obama said he could have been Trayvon. How many Hispanic heads has Obama bashed into concrete sufficient to cause the necessary application it was definitely a two-band-aid boo-boo. Then there's Hugh Hewitt, who sounds like a noise that you make if you mix liquors on Friday night. Yeah, I'll have a glass of wine. I'll have a beer. Ooh, make me a Singapore sling. No, you know what? I want a Long Island iced tea. Tequila sunrise. Hugh Hewitt. This POTUS presser is remarkable, like he fell through the time tunnel to his state senate days. I guess we're just lucky nobody's using the magic N-word. And then there's the oxymoron's baby brother, David. David Flimball. Did Trayvon commit assault with intent to kill? Do we have to overlook, even glorify that in lamenting his death, yet Obama identifies with him? No, Trayvon Martin, oddly enough, did not commit assault with intent to kill. You can, in point of fact, argue, and it was not very artfully argued, I must admit, that if there was a scuffle, Trayvon Martin was defending himself. He was engaging in self-defense, but that it was trumped by Stand Your Ground and a little punk ass with an equalizer in his pocket. Radio Rwanda then asked, in classic Radio Rwanda fashion, is the president easing racial tension or stoking racial tension? And then one last goodie from that organization that rhymes with night fart. I like living in a country where a black president elected twice complains about racism. Hey, John Nolte, dipstick. Go look at the numbers. Get back to me on the racism. Yeah, bring me back the white folks' numbers on people voting for Barack Obama. Then we'll talk about the racism thing. Michael writing in. Subject line. Same difference. Regarding whichever doofus you were quoting earlier, and I understand, Michael, it's hard to keep up with them. There are, well, in my father's house are many doofuses. Regarding whichever doofus you were quoting earlier, to the Reich Wing trying to get American to confront reality, even just a sliver of reality, is the exact same thing as tearing the country apart. No distinction. As the Manic Street Preachers said on their 1994 album, The Holy Bible, via song title, possibly quoting someone else, I'm not sure, if white America told the truth for one day, its world would fall apart. Woo, twoo. Bless her heart. Patty tweeting at me. She didn't mean for them to be... But she said, you know, I'm a few behind, but I have a tiny mark between my eyes and had a bloody nose when it happened. Fired my gun and nailed me to... Rolling around on the ground could scratch your bald little head. There are other answers. I know. I hate to think of the waste myself, Marty. Marty writing in, and just think, all those right-wing nut job tweets all could have been more N Monday nominees. But you know what? As much as it may seem like we just ran through them like a profligate waster of more N Monday nominees, here's the funny thing. There's going to be plenty more. As for me saying no melees, Marty writes, of course there's been melees, Bob. Haven't you heard the Nuge on out? Alex Jones. And there goes forever any credibility Jones has with me. Wait, present tense, Marty? He still had some? And Marty also pointing out, besides, Bob, I'll argue against you that the system really did work. Remember my favorite tweet, how the system fails someone it was never designed to protect. There you go. And Ron and Raleigh writing on the system, in my experience, the system works a lot better when the skids are greased with money. And white privilege. Don't forget that. Let's not sell the white privilege short. So we've got a lot of, we've spent rather a lot of time in the discussion of that particular issue. But don't think for a minute that we are not plenty busy and don't have plenty of stuff to go into for the remainder of More in Monday. Thanks going out to Kate. Thank you, Kate. Kate matched. Kate matched Robert's challenge from Down Under, the Down Under challenge. Thank you very kindly. That leaves us only $110 short. We're getting close. We could actually finish this in the next hour. 11 folks, 10 bucks. Or 5.5 folks, 20 bucks. Me and that math again. Anybody want to match Kate's match? You're free to call her and see it and raise it if you want to. That's how we keep this all on the air. Ron noting, I said it before, as soon as we black folks stop playing the race card, things will be just fine. It's all our fault. This is a post-racial America, KKK, America. We can't have a discussion about racism because there is none, at least not with white folks. Nope, none at all. It's entirely imaginary. Yeah, okay, Marty, I remember. So that's a start. And like I said, lots and lots and lots of stuff to get after in the remainder of the program. Your calls are, of course, welcome. 304-658-3333 is the number. And Agnes will take your calls and relay them to me here in the, here in the headquarters of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign. And Skype is available too, Bob Kincaid Horn on Skype. Had a request. It's an instrumental. But it is one Jim Dandy instrumental. Had a request from Kate. Had to go digging around to find it, but I did find it. Somehow it seems to fit. Flattened Scruggs, Dear Old Dixie. On this here Friday on the front porch, Conversation Radio on the Horn.
I once knew a poet, lived before his time. He and his dog Spooner listen while he'd rhyme. Words to make you happy, words to make you cry. Then one day the poet suddenly did die. But he left behind a closet filled with verse and rhyme. Through some strange transaction, one was printed in the Times. And everybody's searching for the king of underground. Well, they found him down in Florida, tombstone for a crown. Everybody knows a lie from his book that cost $4.99. I wonder if he knows his doing quite this fine, 'cause his books are all best-selling. Poems were turned to song. Had his brother on a talk show, though they never got along. And now he's called immortal. Guess he's even taught in school. They say he used his talent, most proficient too, but he left all of his royalty to Spooner, his old hound. Growing old on steak and bacon in a doghouse 10 feet round. And everybody wonders, did he really his mind? No, he was just a poet who lived before his time. He was just a poet who lived before his time.
6 minutes past the hour. A little soothing music for the interlude there. You know, sometimes breaks are occasioned by the necessity to check in with the boss, Agnes. And that was just such a case. Agnes letting me know that some hell's a-poppin' thunderstorms had blown through and just zapped the hell out of the uninterruptible power supply that was that feeds the phone processor. But not to worry, it held up. It did its job, and the phones are back in service now. And so if you want to jump in on the program, 304-658-3333, when that line's not tied up, we'll go at it on Skype, get in via Skype. Right now, however, Agnes tells me that we've got John from D.C. You there, John?
I'm right here.
Hey, awesome.
Yeah. Dude, I don't even understand, like, why, first of all, this isn't, you know, this whole Trayvon Martin thing, this isn't even, this is so surreal. Like, first of all, the cops should be in jail. They shouldn't be out, you know, wondering if they're going to lose their jobs. They shouldn't be out, you know, wondering why people think they're a bunch of racist KKK stooges. They should be in jail. And the prosecution should be in jail, too, because how could they even put someone like that medical expert on the stand? I mean, that's bullshit. It's complete total bullshit. If it were the other way around, right? Say Trayvon Martin was the guy that shot, you know, let's just, you know, considering that you got corrupt cops, what if it was the corrupt cop's kid and someone that looked like Trayvon Martin shot him? Do you think it'd take this long for any of this stuff to happen?
No. Well, like I said, had it been Trayvon Martin who was standing his ground, Trayvon Martin would not, he'd be dead anyway. The cops would have gunned him down in the street.
Yeah.
And if they didn't do that, they would have taken him into custody. And there would have been no stand your ground defense assertable. He would have been headed for old Sparky.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, oh my gosh. It's so infuriating that it's like, first of all, how the fuck do these people call themselves cops? When they literally left this kid's body, in the morgue for like 3 fucking days before they looked for his parents? I mean,
wasn't it?
That's like some sort of like weird Gestapo Nazi bullshit, you know? Let's see if we can leave him somewhere for a few days, no one will notice. You know, he's a 17-year-old kid. I don't care. I've seen these comments. People are like, oh, he was 17. It wasn't really a kid. Yeah. Okay, when it's their kid that's getting killed, when they're 17, try telling those parents that their kid isn't really a kid because he's 17. I mean, it's so bizarre. It's almost like we're living in like pre-19 or 1880s America.
John, in many ways we are.
What's that?
I said, in many ways we are.
Yeah.
I mean, there are. It's like the song quote that Michael sent along a little bit ago. What was that? Let me find it again real quick. Here it is. If white America told the truth for one day, its world would fall apart.
Yeah, you got Wall Street bankers, right? Who pull in what, like 1.5 easily a year, right? Stealing billions of dollars from American families, you know, en masse, right? Like, from thousands of people. The police never touched them, but you got one kid trying to walk home, and the police are just like, you know, F you, you're not even human, we're not going to look for the parents, we're just going to leave you here for a few days, and hopefully no one will give a shit. I mean, it's like, where the fuck does anyone come off? How do these people even consider themselves human? Okay, much less authorities of any sort. That's just so. there's so many different, like, fucked up facets to this story that I don't even know where to start.
Well, the whole thing is a disaster. And it's a disaster that begins long before the evening in question, John. It begins, I remember stories associated with Florida's Stand Your Ground law long before this ever happened. I remember when the right wing threw a hissy because Disney said, we don't care about your concealed carry laws. We don't care about your Stand Your Ground laws. No guns are going to be allowed at Disney World. And the right wing, well, they don't love freedom and the Second Amendment. And what about government tyranny? And we want to take our shooting guns on this adventure Space Mountain, damn it.
That's another thing. Is they always get offended that they can't violate someone else's rights. You know, if someone else is offended, oh, how dare you be offended, you know, by our obvious encroachment on your civil rights. It's oh, my gosh, I don't even know. Like, what? That's like me walking up to Rush Limbaugh, right, and just flattening the fucker. And then he gets up and he's like,
Now, we try not to fantasize on this program too much, John.
No, I'm not it's just that it's like, that's what they do, is they think, okay, if we can't violate someone's civil rights, then obviously that person doesn't care about our civil rights. That's what Republicans do. Every week, they come out with some new way that their inability to trample on someone else's rights is hurting their rights.
Right, and see, necessarily, if the President of the United States talks about the issue of race in a way that tries to get America to be a little bit empathetic with it, then that makes him the racist.
Exactly. You know, I mean, it's bad enough for them that he's African-American. You know, he's actually expressing a feeling on television, you know, but then he's also expressing a feeling that disagrees with their own. So it's like doubly worse. Oh my gosh!
Well, I can tell you're flustered, and you know that. I guess there's something to be said that it's good that you are, John, because
right.
You're not just saying, "Oh well, you know, it's just another day in America, lock and load."
Well, this is 2013. This isn't 1960 with, you know, Bull Connor and fucking, you know, Jim Crow and all that stuff. This is supposed to be the 21st century. I'm supposed to be a part of this 21st century generation, yet here we are with a bunch of crooked pigs and a prosecutor's office that couldn't prosecute a Rottweiler for tearing up a chicken. You know, that's how stupid these people are, and yet somehow they get to call themselves authorities or representatives of civil rights. That's ridiculous. There's no reasonable, rational explanation. Like, this, forget everything that's happened over the past decade, alright? Because it's not related, okay? But there are just so many examples of stuff that's happened just in 10 years that you could say, what world do these people live in? Right? And this is just one more thing. So, to a certain degree, I'm not apathetic, but it's like, yeah, okay, all right, one more crooked pig, you know, one more prosecutor that doesn't really care if a black kid happens to be trying to walk home and someone, you know, and this happens. And so, in a way, I guess it's not surprising, but it's still like, come on, this is 2013.
I know, that keeps happening to me. I keep saying, wait, is it really 2013? The 21st century? We're supposed to be past this 50 years, next month, 50 years since the rally in Washington with Dr. King and the speech that white folks only know two lines out of, I have a dream, and judge people on the content of their character and not the color of their skin. 50 years.
Yeah.
And it frustrates me because, well, A, I don't know, maybe I got no business even talking about this because I can't, you know, it hasn't happened to me. And all I can do is try to be open and sympathetic about it and maybe empathetic or empathic about it. But it's been 50 years. And we can't, South Africa had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in which everybody came forward and just told the truth, and then hopefully there was reconciliation and nobody was punished. And we can't even do that.
Right. No, I mean, if you looked at even that, like, that didn't happen until what, like the 80s? When was the clerk thrown out? Like 70, late 70s?
Well, it's with the arrival of Nelson Mandela that happens in order to try to keep the country from just devolving into chaos and civil war, because it was going to benefit no one.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, but it's like, you know, it's like if you say to someone, and this is just an analogy, would you say to someone, all right, I want you to come visit this museum, all right, and then you invite them into the museum, and half the stuff in the museum is just lies, okay? So then you're like, well, listen, you know what, I'm so sorry about all this, but I want you guys to have an enjoyable visit, so let me just apologize, but we'll keep the lies up, you know? So they have to.
You immediately remind me of the Creation Museum down in Kentucky somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I mean, that's exactly what that is. Everything in here is lies, but y'all come back now, you hear?
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing, too. It's like there's no historical reference point. You know, obviously, back in, like, the Inquisition, you know, they were doing that kind of stuff. Oh, you don't believe a word. What we're trying to tell you, you're obviously heretics or something, you know, and it's like, do they see any relation between a museum that propagates a very singular point of view in a country that professes, multi-views and multi-theologies, there's no historical reference point. It's like, do you guys not realize how antithetical this is to a democracy, to a pluralistic society? And of course they don't. So
you have to come at this, John, from an understanding that from the moment that white people set foot on this continent, the dominant emotion has been fear. Scared of everything, terrified of everything, and their response to their terror was to try to subjugate those who terrified them. They killed off the native population as expeditiously as they possibly could, and then they re and then and it's a complicated piece of history, but they discovered that they couldn't work this ground. Because they kept dying of malaria.
Right.
So they had, long before the Americas, bond slavery had been introduced off the African coast and into the island communities, and it travels from there.
Right.
But it's all been fear. Every last bit of it has been fear. The Constitution was drafted out of fear.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that's where the three-fifths compromise comes from. Fear. And yeah, I know it may seem overly simplistic, but it's true, John. It's true. Fear.
No, I totally agree. I mean, from a psychological point of view, it's we got fear and greed as the primary motivators. But I just don't understand, like, how can we be in an age where, you know, we've got all this great technology, all this information, we're in the quote-unquote information age, and yet we're still sort of like, we haven't moved past that initial...
No, but you mentioned technology, John, and I have to address that, because we tend to look at technology in the hopes that someday it's going to be, oh, I don't know, used for peaceful Star Trek-y kind of purposes. But,
right. But
the fact of the matter is, every time technology has come along just about... somebody's found a way to use it to hurt somebody else. Remember, you know, the Nobel Prize, the Nobel Peace Prize, named for Alfred Nobel, the guy who invented TNT, and he said it was such a terrible, terrible weapon that humankind would finally learn not to make war anymore because the use of such an explosive would be too horrifying to contemplate. What happened? Right. What happened?
Well, then they came up with the atom bomb.
Right, but not before they found really, really the horrifying uses for TNT. The same thing with the Gatling gun. The Gatling gun was introduced, and, well, you know, this thing fires so fast that it'll just mow down people, and nobody would ever want to go to war against a weapon like that.
Right.
And out of that, we've got, well, the Gatling gun, please. We've got weapons that shoot, you know, ungodly numbers of rounds per second. Per second. How long did it take Adam Lanza to stitch a bunch of first graders into pieces? And Marty, you know, Marty just wrote in and he said the technology improves, but humankind is still version 1.0.
Right. Exactly.
And that's the thing.
Yeah,
we seek, in the case of Nobel's TNT or the Gatling gun or whatever, we ostensibly seek to end war by coming up with more novel ways to kill people, which is really a bad way to end violence. Because somebody, there's always going to be a psychopath. And
yeah,
sometimes psychopaths get hold of the reins of power. It has happened. It has happened time and time again. I think of Caligula,
right?
Or just march on forward through history. There was one guy in the 13th or 14th century Europe that was just He would ally with it, just constantly scheming, allying with anybody in order to keep things unbalanced so that he eventually could, you know, be big time. And God, he wound up burning to death or something. Incredibly fitting. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the other thing, too, is that you can't, like, technology doesn't erase human emotion. You know, you're always going to, regardless of what kind of technology you've got, I mean, look at Edward Snowden, perfect example. You got all this amazing technology. You got one human with an emotion that differs from the objective of the technology, and who cares about technology? I mean, it's completely neutralized by an emotion.
Well, or by madness. Or by by nationalist desires, or fill in the blanks.
I guess that's what I mean by emotion. You got the human factor versus the technological objective, and if one doesn't necessarily match the other, then it doesn't really matter how much technology you've got. You know, Vietnam's a great example of that too. You had America, which at that point still had the most advanced weaponry in the world. Going into a country with a bunch of people that were fighting with, you know, like sticks and stuff and booby traps, and we got our asses kicked by a bunch of rice paddy farmers who were like, you know, fuck you,
whose land we invaded.
Right, but we had all the technology. We're so amazing with the technology, and they were just like, yeah, we don't care about your technology. You're still going home, but not the way you came.
Yeah. Didn't somebody say that in Iraq we would be greeted as liberators?
Yeah, right. How many YouTube videos can you see? If you go to liveleak.com and look up Iraq war footage, there must be like 300 or 400 videos of the exact opposite of that.
Yeah, of stuff that never showed up in the for-profit media back here in the land of the free and Homer the Brave.
Right, and there's what, like 4,000-plus Americans that ended up paying for that mistake?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And continue to pay, because we're still in Afghanistan. It's worth remembering. Yeah.
Yeah, well, have you seen the movie Restrepo?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
You remember at the end of the movie what happened to them? They just left. They're like, "Oh, we can't."
They fought tooth and toenail for that furthest outpost in Afghanistan, and then the brass said, "You know what? We're done now. Come on home."
Yeah. Yeah, and how many people died there in just that little, you know.
Yeah, you know what, people, I'm glad you mentioned that, John. People should make it a point to, because Restrepo is offered not as, you know, not as a commentary. It's largely unbiased. It's just, it just is what it is. It really, it's a pretty good example of the documentary filmmaker's art and craft.
Yeah. You mean Sebastian Unger?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean that's the thing too. Is that, have you seen Iraq for Sale by Robert Greenwald?
Yes.
Okay, I mean that's like you, they had. I think you even refer to it sometimes. You like the Halliburgers that were like $30.
Yeah, the 20. Yeah, I'll have a Halliburger with cheese. $29.
I mean, wasn't.
And to be fair, that's not mine. That's a classic frame. From Doonesbury.
Okay.
But it's based on reality. And I remember in the days of the Iraq War, the stories about the Halliburton kitchens with with rotten, blood-sodden meat laying around and rotting vegetables being served to the... Yeah.
Oof. Yeah, but, I mean, that's like... Wasn't war profiteering illegal up until a point? Like, back in World War II, it was like you couldn't profit. You weren't allowed to profit from war. And then I don't even know when that went away, but at a certain point they're like, you know what? Forget that. We need war contracts and Halliburton and KBR. I mean, isn't it like, correct me if I'm wrong, but hasn't KBR basically been almost the primary corporate motivator behind every war since like the Korean War? Like they were in.
Well, they certainly hit their stride in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And they started out as a little construction company. And they got some patronage from LBJ as a senator, building dams and things like that. And then they went pro with the Vietnam War.
Right. Were they the people that did what's that Robert Duvall line? I love the smell of napalm. Was KBR were they the napalm developers?
Well, in Vietnam they were referred to as Kellogg Burn and Loot.
I've never heard that. Wow. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I just don't. I mean, how can they? Because that was 1970s. So then you got 30 years, and in that 30 years, we didn't learn anything, and then they were around in the Iraq War in 2003 or 4 or whatever.
And you despair sometimes. No. Because, see, and this is something, I mean, I remember the horror with which we all listened to the audio when the Trayvon Martin killing started getting national attention. Mm. And I remember saying, well, don't be shocked. It's going to happen again and again and again and again. You know, up in Milwaukee, they've been trying a guy who shot a 13-year-old kid point blank in the chest to teach him a lesson because the 76-year-old man was quite convinced that he had come in and boosted some guns from his house and then said to the police that he was stressed out because he'd had lung cancer surgery and he'd lost his wife and somebody broke into his home and blah, 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 blah. And so he blew away a 13-year-old kid who happened to have dark skin.
Wow.
But apparently the jury did, in Wisconsin, the jury at least had the common decency to reject his insanity plea.
Yeah, well, I think I saw the video of him. It was a silent video. There was no audio, but I think I saw the video of that, and the guy just, he took his time. You know, it wasn't like the heat of passion, you know, something horrible was happening. He didn't know. He took his time. You know, that lasted like 4 minutes before anything even happened. He was just out. First of all, I think you saw him. The kid comes out with the trash can, because he's taking the trash out for his mom, and you see the guy go back in his house and then come out.
Yeah, that's the one.
Right. And then
stop and consider that for a minute. This is a country where mama can't say, son, take the garbage out, and expect son to come back in alive.
Yeah.
I mean, just let that just, and especially people listening outside this country, understand that that is America. You have to worry about your child from the front door to the sidewalk taking out the trash.
Right. Yeah, and then if anything happens, of course, you'll have people saying things like, well, yeah, but, you know, black people do this and black people do that, you know, as if that has any relevance at all. You know, they won't just address the situation. They'll just try to generalize as an excuse.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's I don't know. That's almost, it's not worse than the crime itself, but it's like, can you imagine anyone saying to, I don't know, just imagine that the kid was white and the perpetrator was black. Can you imagine anyone saying on the news, yeah, but you know, you got all these Caucasian skateboarders and stuff doing all this mischievous stuff, so, you know, what do you expect? I mean, can you even imagine anyone even thinking of saying something like that in that event?
Oh, don't take me there.
What?
Don't take me there, but, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's, yeah. So, I just don't even know, like, I don't know. And then wasn't there another instance besides that of some guy going up to a bunch of kids in a car?
Yeah, that one's going on too, yes.
Their music too loudly, it's like, okay. I mean, that's the other thing too, is like,
and shot the kid sitting in the back seat who couldn't do a damn thing about the music.
Right, and he had like he might have had, I don't know, for all the guy knew, he had a fruit roll up. You know, he's like, oh, and he lifted something. It's like, okay, well, you know, that doesn't necessarily
again,
mean anything.
But again, that's what you get with stand your ground. Because, I mean, go read, don't take my word for it, John. Go read the statute yourself. And I'm not being mean. Just go read it. Because if you are put in fear, you can draw down and bust a cap in somebody in Florida.
Well, and that's the other thing.
I mean, the whole concept just scares the piss out of me.
Yeah, but isn't it a product of Alec?
Yeah, Alec. Yeah, that's Alec. And there's
okay,
God knows how many other states that have those damn things.
And how is it that the people that enforce these laws or directly sponsor them aren't treated as accessories after the fact? You know, that doesn't make any sense to me either. How is it that you can support a law that ends up basically getting, I don't know how many people have died as a result of this, but getting that many people killed and those people aren't accessories after the fact? Yeah, that's, I mean, obviously, you know, they're not directly there, they don't have any knowledge of it, yada, yada, yada. But, I mean, it doesn't seem any different from, you know, someone who says to a bunch of soldiers, all right, listen, I want you to go over there and go after this, and the soldiers get killed. Doesn't the person giving the orders have any kind of culpability for that? I mean, you know, obviously this isn't a war scenario. I'm just saying, it doesn't make sense. You got these people sponsoring legislation that gets people killed, murdered, and they have no responsibility whatsoever. They're just like, oh, well, you know, that's not our fault.
Right, because what? Freedom, right?
Well, and that's the thing, too, is that back in the 60s, half the reason why, you know, people like Emmett Till or Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney were being murdered was because supposedly they were uncivilized.
They were outside agitators.
Exactly. That's exactly the word they used.
Yes,
agitators,
it was.
Right.
Outside agitators.
Yeah, but you got these people saying that
coming down here and trying to tell us how to live our lives.
Mm-hmm. Right, and they're like, oh, they insisted that they're so civilized, you know, they don't need any agitators coming in and disrupting the civilization, right? But the civilization are a bunch of people who routinely took community photos wherein innocent civilians were just being hanged. And you got all these...
No, white folks used to take picnic baskets to lynchings, okay? I mean, it really happened.
Yeah, that's exactly it, too. That's what I'm talking about. It's like, how much civilization do you have when you got, you know, Ma and Pa and the whole family standing around with three innocent people strung up in a tree?
Yeah.
That's, yeah.
Well, John, it's good talking to you this evening, man.
Yeah, thank you, Bob.
You have yourself a good weekend, and hopefully we'll talk soon.
Yeah, I'll call in soon. Thank you.
All right, later. Bye now. Calling, from around here, I guess. That's John, and we will go onward. Juanita is on the line.
Hey, Bob, how you doing?
I'm well, Juanita. How about you?
I'm doing okay. I hear there's a storm brewing in your area.
It's been kind of storm. It's just been hot and nasty here. But back home at the mansion in West Virginia, it's blowing hell bent for leather.
Well, my aunt, who's lives in Beckley, is terrified of storms. And when I lived in Beckley, I was telling Agnes that we had to cut off all the lights. It'd be real quiet. Be unplugged everything.
Yeah.
But anyway, I briefly want to talk about the Trayvon Martin thing.
Sure.
If I could, Bob.
Go ahead.
And, the media, I mean, maybe people think it's just so simplistic to blame the media, but they really do perpetuate the worst in American culture. And now with the 24-hour cable news shows, I mean, it's just bloody awful. And, I don't understand why they feel the need. Well, of course, it's for ratings. But they will bring these people on, like Newt Gingrich and Ted Nugent and whatever, because they know what they're going to say. And then they'll turn around and say, well, why do we have racism? Well, because you're helping to validate it by bringing these people on.
Yeah.
You know, most races, I mean, just like with Zimmerman, when the case first happened and they said he would call the police and that he was obsessed with black men, well, I knew right then and there that kind of racism doesn't come in a vacuum. You usually get it from a parent or there's something, you've learned that from somebody, that kind of obsessive racism. And I think for the most part, racists, they feel validated. And that's why, I mean, it's just like those people, those horrible people, the Westboro Baptist people, they are being validated by somebody. Something is validating them, and it's not God. But I believe there is some power that is given them.
Uh-oh. I'm trying to find out what happened to Juanita. Oh. Apparently, Agnes just sent me a weather bulletin for back home at the mansion. Ah, the phones took a hit. Well, it might be one of those nights. I apologize, Juanita. Okay. This was followed by a number of exclamation points. Agnes writing, freaking me out. All right, sweetheart. Why don't you shut down and we'll go Skype only here. I'm going to hang up with the boss. And if you want to get involved in the conversation now, you are limited strictly to Skype, and you Skype in directly to Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn. Thanks going out to everybody who's helping us make our fundraising goal for the evening. Thank you to Robert in Australia for getting us started with his challenge that was answered by Kate. And thanks, Sal, for jumping in this evening. That leaves us only $100. $100 from making the week's fundraising goal. So hopefully that will happen in the next hour or so. And again, if you want to jump into the conversation, Bob Kincaid Horn on Skype. There are other things to go into, like this. So I've been pissing and moaning all week about how unbearably hot it is here in D.C., and I'm reading other people writing about how ungodly hot it is in places like New York and Boston. I was listening to Malloy last night, and he was saying, you know, it's been unseasonably not miserable this summer. I think it's probably got something to do with the jet stream, climate change, that kind of thing. But it is, to say the least, awfully damned hot in a place like Ohio. And as of, what's the date of this story? This is just one of those little examples of how brutal this country has become in the exercise of its punishment fetish. The dateline on this story is today, Columbus, Ohio. Heat spurs reduction in power cuts in prisons. How many different, and I know it probably doesn't strike you as particularly accurate for me to describe a prison population as fragile, but it is. There's nobody in any prison in Ohio who has, freedom because they're incarcerated, right? You can't sue them. They can't be sued. They can't. No. They are not even second-class citizens. We balance the budgets on the backs of the poor by cutting food stamps. And now, in Ohio, there was a plan to cut off electricity in Ohio's prisons, and there were there's a lot of them, as a means of saving money in a state where the governor wants to reward the rich by cutting their taxes. Alan Johnson's article in the Columbus Dispatch says, state officials yesterday scaled back the number of prisons where electricity use will be curtailed under a power supply agreement. Only prisons in Marion, Cleveland, and Youngstown dialed down electricity use yesterday as the heat index approached 100 degrees. On Monday and Tuesday, electricity was restricted in 24 prisons as a result of a contract that has generated $1.3 million for the state over 3 years. What? I guess prisoners got to be good for something, don't they? I mean, not that we're going to bother rehabilitating or anything. We're warehousing them. Ricky Safang, spokeswoman for the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Correction, said the severe heat caused the agency to review its power policy because, you know, electricity is a luxury in prison, I guess. By God, if they had an electric chair, it wouldn't be. Prompting a request to limit the multi-hour power interruptions to just 5 prisons. Chillicothe Correctional Institution, Marion Correctional Institution, Northeast Pre-Release Center in Cleveland, Pickaway Correctional Institution in Orient, and Ohio Penitentiary in Youngstown all have backup generators. Other prisoners will be subject to power curtailments, but they will be limited to an hour. Mike Bricker, ACLU Director of Communications and Public Policy, said times are difficult and government agencies are looking for revenue anywhere they can find it. Cutting the power during a heat wave to make money is very short-sighted. Long-term, it is a recipe for trouble. And as usual, this all has to do with the beautiful little moment in capitalism. Power interruptions are part of a 2010 agreement signed by the state with Core Energy Limited, a contractor that works with PJM, the company that oversees electricity transmission in 13 states and the District of Columbia. The state agency has received payments totaling about $1.3 million over the past 3 years in exchange for agreeing to drastically cut its electric use on 2-hour notice. The state is paid quarterly, regardless of whether the power is interrupted. Although most Ohio prison cells and housing units are not air-conditioned, power for lights, fans, televisions, and other electrical devices was shut off on 2 afternoons for 3 to 4 hours. Electrified fences and all security systems, of course, remained operational. Air conditioning remained on in staff offices, which normally have it. Welcome to austerity. Welcome to a nation that is so far gone down the rabbit hole that we don't even consider electricity as being something of which the people it is trying to punish deserve. Oh, but they've got backup generators, right? This is that fiscal conservatism that we hear so much about. And, of course, bear in mind, since it seems to have been a large part of the nature of the conversation this evening, bear in mind that, as with the rest of the country, the Ohio prison population is disproportionately racially divided, suffice to say. So, yeah, when we talk about cutting electricity in 100-degree heat in Ohio prisons, we're talking about cutting electricity in large part for people of color, many of whom may be there for crimes that might not even ought to be crimes. Some of whom are there, and very necessarily so, regardless of race. But you see, when the state decides that it is going to deprive someone of their freedom, certain obligations devolve upon the state, unless, of course, the state simply wishes to go ahead and kill them. And even then, the Constitution says that they can't, I mean, for instance, you know, you can't execute a prisoner by staking them out in the noonday sun and putting honey all over them and letting the ants loose. Because that's cruel and unusual. When the state decides to deprive someone of their freedom, obligations devolve upon the state of at least bare minimums of the exercise of humane restraint. You can't just beat them for the fun of it. Well, that happens. Well, I mean, you can't just sell them to the highest bidder and work them to death. Oh, that happens too. But you get the idea. You have to, and California seems to have a hard time doing it. God knows, Mississippi and Angola and Louisiana have a hard time doing it. See, states like the idea of being able to deprive someone of their liberty, but they don't like the obligations that come with it. Consequently, it turns out that turning the electricity off in a damn heat wave turns out to be a great way to make money for the state of Ohio run by John Kasich. And I will simply submit that schemes like that tell you that this experiment that is this nation is teetering on the brink of disaster. Because how is an incarcerated person supposed to feel about that? What are they supposed to think about the agency that purports to be rehabilitating them? Well, that pretense is largely gone anyway, isn't it? Yeah, I think so. You get the idea. But we've got other exhibits in the Museum of Conservative Economics. And we can get into any and all of them. I need to check in with Agnes and make sure everything's okay. And we'll be back. Like I said, your calls welcome on the Skype line, Bob Kincaid Horn. Thank you to Juanita for kicking in to this evening's fundraising. That takes us down to $85 we need to raise this evening. It is much appreciated. I'll bet you we can get there. Sure does help when we do. This is Conversation Radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. And this is Dead Air. Oh, well, while I check in with the boss, we will just go to silence. Maybe some Glockenspiel music. All right, let's try this some more. it's a little creepy over there over at the mansion. Agnes telling me they're waiting for the hail to start. That's going to be delightful. This is Friday on the Front Porch on the Horn, and we've got the state of Ohio making money by turning electricity off for the prisoners. That's charming. And then this, and again, just an example of the glories of conservative monetary policy. There have been two really scary tuberculosis outbreaks in the country of late, one in Florida and now one in South Carolina. Rick Scott, Governor, Nikki Haley, South Carolina. In South Carolina, they had an outbreak of tuberculosis, for heaven's sakes. Aren't we supposed to have this under control? Well, I mean, a civilized country would. The news story noting from the Associated Press the director of South Carolina's public health agency says a botched investigation into a tuberculosis outbreak at a Greenwood County school endangered the public. You know, tuberculosis is quite virulent when it really gets a foothold. Director Catherine Templeton first told the state newspaper she fired employees because of the missteps that left people in the dark. At least four workers at the Department of Health and Environmental Control were fired over it. DHEC screwed this up, Catherine Templeton said. I'm sort of as indignant and angry about it as anybody else. It's not how I run the railroad. It's why they were fired. My goodness. I probably got the accent all wrong for that, too, but you get the idea. It's not how I run the railroad. Well, it's also not how South Carolina... I mean, you know, forget about it, Jake. It's South Carolina, Stan, right? Lord God. More than 100 people in Greenwood County, South Carolina, including more than 50 children, have tested positive for germs associated with tuberculosis, the pathogens of which are airborne and spread via the air. Most of them are asymptomatic. 12, however. And that's 12 too many in a country that likes to pretend that it still has the last vestiges of civilization still clinging tentatively to its body politic. A dozen of them have developed active tuberculosis disease. Of that dozen, 10 are children. It started at 96 South Carolina, that really is a town, 96, primary school, with a janitor there. Parents are upset that they were not notified until after the janitor's case was reported to the agency on March 8th. Children were not tested until May 31st. Well, them government regulations, job killing regulations. I mean, we can't be running because, you know, states' rights. The Department of Health, Environment, and Environmental Control is being sued. That's why they've fired people. Catherine Templeton said she didn't even learn about it until she made an unannounced visit to the regional office on May the 20th. Remember, the janitor's case was reported to DHEC March 8th. This is what happens when you let these people, when you let so-called conservatives, who are really just Ayn Randian acolytes, run government because they don't believe in government. What, you know, what business? I mean, what business does government have keeping up with whether or not some? See, this is, it's like that Osmond guy said from Utah. You know, if we quit making parents send their children to school, the little children wouldn't get tuberculosis. See, government bad. Fire bad. Rawr. Government worse. Rawr. It only gets better. The agency in March tested teachers who used a room that shared a vent with the janitor's work area. Catherine Templeton said when asked why these children weren't tested, the response was that the teachers were taller. There were What? When asked why the children weren't tested, the response was that apples don't grow on trees in June or in January. When asked why the children were not tested, the answer was that because the sky is blue and you can't see air. When asked why these children weren't tested, the response was that the teachers were taller. That meant that they were closer to the vent and more likely to breathe the air. Because, you know, germs travel with little helium balloons attached to them, and they never fall down to the level where the little children are. There were policies and procedures in place these nurses didn't follow. If they did, the investigation wouldn't have lagged for a month and a half. Here's the funny part. Still, Catherine Templeton says no one got sick because of the delay. The medical damage, they assert, was done before March the 8th, when a doctor reported the janitor's case as required by state law. And he was taken out of the school. By that time, his case had become very advanced. Attorney John Reckenbile, who apparently is a bit of an optimist, said that Catherine Templeton should have known about this sooner. There should be safeguards and procedures. Well, yeah, Attorney Reckenbile, there should be safeguards and procedures if you actually happen to live in a state that believes in the concept of governance. If, on the other hand, you live in South Carolina, where the idea of government is itself anathema, unless that government is on the, in the business of passing out goodies to rich people, well, no, that no. Jesus, tuberculosis. What's next? Bubonic plague in Alabama? Ebola in Georgia? You know, because states' rights. Our country is being picked to pieces by the ALEC, and by the NRA, and by the Koch brothers, and in North Carolina by Art Pope. What is it at the end of Henry V, in talking about Henry VI, the chorus says, and so many people had the run, talking about the kingdom, and so many people had the running of it that they tore it all to pieces. Well, this isn't that. They're tearing it all to pieces because they don't want it to run. Because government is conceptually course, it's not just here. I suppose you've probably seen by now that all of those things that we feared would come out of the Fukushima disaster are beginning to come true. TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power, recently admitted that nearly 2,000 people who tried to stem the tide of horror and damage arising out of that nuclear nightmare there now officially have a heightened risk, what's being described as a heightened risk of thyroid cancer. And if they're saying that nearly 2,000 people have that risk, and being as how it's TEPCO, you can just about bet that the real risk is a hell of a lot higher. Because that 1,973 people, that's 10% of the people who were among the emergency crews that have worked on the site trying to do cleanup since they melted down and since they went to core on the floor. Even so, that's 10 times what TEPCO was previously willing to admit. That, you know, Fukushima has largely gone off the radar unless you're somebody like our buddy Tim, who keeps watching and trying to keep up with it in manifest horror because he has loved ones there. See, back in December, TEPCO reported to the World Health Organization that, well, gosh, only 178 workers at the plant were believed to have gotten big enough radiation doses to do any real thyroid damage. Yeah, now it's 1,973, which probably means it's more like, you know, 10,000. God knows. But, you know, as long as it serves do right by TEPCO's quarterly profit and loss statements, well, you know, that's fine, right? Because profit. It just goes on. On and on. Eventually, the profit people will be the death of all of us. And that I don't mean to just be a little beacon of sunshine here on Friday evening, but, well, damn, it sure looks like that, doesn't it? Exactly, Mr. Gibson, in the chat room, noting profit trumps people. Our chat room moderator, Lottie, noting with regard to the South Carolina story, you know, here being Massachusetts, the state health agency would have been at the school the day the janitor was reported. But that's because there is still, and Massachusetts is far from perfect, but there's still some notion in places like Massachusetts that government has a real purpose in life beyond the enrichment of the already rich. I suspect, just sort of bouncing around here, I suspect we are going to see more and more nightmares coming out of Fukushima. You know, it was just yesterday that it was reported in a story by Hiroko Tabuchi at the New York Times. A damaged reactor at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant suddenly began releasing steam again. But TEPCO said, it didn't appear to be a result of renewed nuclear reactions or anything. You know, this stuff just happens. But There have also been indications that radioactive water may have been leaking into the ocean. But, you know, you wouldn't want to come up with a really dynamic response to the overall miserable negligence of TEPCO because, well, that would be government, well, freedom! Wolverines! Right? TEPCO said it based its conclusion that there was no new chain reaction at reactor number 3 on its failure to find xenon, a byproduct of fission that lingers for only a few hours and would be an indication of new nuclear activity. TEPCO also said the temperature remained stable. On the other hand, Hiroki Kawamata, who is a spokesman for TEPCO, said, well, they just weren't really sure what it is that's generating that steam. And, well, maybe it's rainwater seeping into... Wait, what? Rainwater seeping? Rainwater seeping and damaged reactor. That, you know, those are just words that you don't want to hear together. Rainwater seeping into the reactor's damaged containment vessel may have turned to vapor because of the heat inside the vessel. If there's heat in there, and this is, and remember, it's a nuclear reactor, isn't there a little radiation, too? Or a lot. On the other hand, the New York Times contacted a man by the name of David Lockbaum. He's a nuclear analyst at the Union of Concerned Scientists. He said, you know, there's a lot of different things that could produce steam in a banged up, deeply damaged reactor. Yeah, heck, it could just be a live electrical cable falling into a puddle. What the hell? No, TEPCO still hasn't managed to get any kind of cover, a meaningful covering over the reactor building. And workers can't replace the roof until they've removed all the radioactive debris from the upper sections of the building. They have to use remote control cranes for that. Rapid rises in temperature would indicate a possibility of criticality in the reactor's damaged fuel, most of which is thought to have melted and slumped, what a lovely word in this context, and slumped to the bottom of its containment structure after a hydrogen explosion. They would hope that if they injected boric acid into it would somehow choke off a nuclear reaction. And yes, they would hope. They would expect it. Interestingly, the word missing from this description is they know it would. It goes on and on and on. Back in April, the cooling system shut down for hours on end. Asked why that was, TEPCO said, well, you know, a rat. A rat? A rat short-circuited a switchboard, maybe by gnawing on cables. Really? A rat can live there? How big a rat? The science fiction movie rat? How long does your average wharf rat or whatever kind of rat that was, really, rats can survive nuclear radiation on a massive, wow. A rat. Because they can't keep the rats out. TEPCO. For-profit nuclear energy. The fuel of the future. Future, future, future. And what this all boils down to is they have no freaking clue of what this is or what it's going to be. The number 3 reactor's damaged core, like the cores of 2 other crippled reactors at the site, is being cooled by water that is pumped into the reactor, filtered, and recycled. Filtered. Among recent mishaps, the rat story. and people, and some people are beginning to return to their homes that are not right on top of the site. Steam. Yeah, steam that just, you know, popped up there. Steam. Sparky telling me a switchboard is a power distribution panel. Appreciate that. And a nuclear radiated rat could go and just gnaw on something like that. And big, sharp teeth. Yeah, Lottie. You're funny, Lottie. Bob, it was all that smoking we made the rats do. They're impervious to the radiation now. They have a grudge and they're getting even, says Waggy. Is this the part where I cue up Donald Fagen singing what a wonderful world this will be, what a glorious time to be free? Well, it's either that or, I don't know, is there a Japanese version of Lee Greenwood singing God Bless the... Oh, and by the way, Isaac sent this along earlier. The FISA court has been busy. According to Reuters, who, by the way, did you catch that story the other day? Reuters doesn't like to report on climate change. A former Reuters correspondent dropped a dime on him and said, every time I tried to write about climate change, they said, can't you find something else to write about? There's that for-profit media for you. Oh, damn, ExxonMobil won't advertise with us. Yeah. But anyway, a Reuters report, Dateline Washington, the U.S. government said Friday, today, late in the afternoon news dump kind of thing, that the secret FISA court, or you can think of it as the Court of Star Chamber, if you like, that oversees U.S. surveillance programs has granted its request to continue seeking certain telephone records of Americans. And of course they did. The Office of the Director of National Intelligence said its authority, is that James Clapper? Clap on, clap off, he's the clapper. Said its authority to maintain the program expired on July 19th. Well, whatever would they do if it... And so they went, they hide themselves, hence, back to the FISA court, the secret FISA court, whose members have been appointed by John Roberts, whose decisions are not reviewable by the Supreme Court, apparently. The government sought and received a renewal from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Court. But, Proles, the government is disclosing the renewal as part of an effort at greater transparency after former, blah, blah, blah. In other words, hello, America, we're spying on you. Happy now? Anybody surprised? Yeah, been spying on you for almost a decade now. Good. Everybody clear on that now? All right, good. Go back to your televisions and shut them up. So we can all sleep tight tonight, right? Yeah. Yeah, or not. And then this. We've known for a while now that Texas has a problem with women. But I want to put this to you as a question of degree. And I'm not asking rhetorically. This is a sincere question. Up to 13 men in Texas cheered as they filmed each other raping a 13-year-old girl, according to an Austin police report. The little girl told detectives she was picked up by three strangers after running away from Settlement Home for Children. Oh, look, Settlement Home for Children, a place that's supposed to, oh, well, I mean, government. It's probably for-profit or not-for-profit, but run as a business and subcontracted via a lend-lease agreement to the government. Oh, Jesus. She ran away from Settlement Home for Children on June 30th. She was taken to the Avalon Palms Apartments in Austin and raped by somewhere between 10 and 13 men. Two have been arrested, Juan Lozano Ortega and Edgar Gerardo Guzman. And the men cheered and took video with their cell phones. The rape, according to the arrest investigation report, lasted several hours. Then they took her into a nearby neighborhood, dropped her on the sidewalk, and said, "Find somewhere to go." State child welfare investigators are also investigating Settlement Home for Children, which allegedly takes care of abused and neglected girls under the age of 18. I remember a few years ago when they had that one Christian outfit that took care of troubled children that was dragging them behind trucks. Is this the same outfit? Yeah. Our mission is to promote healing and growth in children, young adults, and families by providing a continuum of care, support, and resources. Nice. Spa Day. Relax and unwind at Spa Day on Friday, July 19th. Experience a day of pampering that benefits not only you, but also the Settlement Home for Children. Spa Day. Is that what they call it now? But I have a question. And again, it is not a hypothetical question. It is not rhetorical in nature. What is the difference between the 10 men or 13 who cheered and videoed as a 13-year-old little girl was raped? Essentially, what is the philosophical difference between those men and the men in the Texas legislature who have now decided that they want to eliminate a woman's right to manage the functioning of her own body and access to reproductive health care after the sixth week of pregnancy? Because remember, a lot of these guys don't support the idea of letting a woman terminate a pregnancy that is the function of rape, that is the byproduct of rape. Here's a 13-year-old little girl who was most assuredly, I mean, there's no question in anybody's mind that she was raped, the rape kit. Oh, by the way, she won't be getting pregnant. Because Luckenbach Barbie, remember Luckenbach Barbie? Who said that, well, she can go to a hospital and they got these rape kits and that cleans everything out. Well, they ran a rape kit on this 13-year-old little girl. And they got the evidence, and the evidence does tend to back up her version of events of having been repeatedly raped by 10 to 13 individuals. and she will not, would not, under the good, upstanding, Christian, God-fearing policies promulgated by the Texas legislature, have access to the reproductive health care she would need in order to keep from having a rape baby. And thus, my question. What is the difference between the men who raped the little 13-year-old girl and the men who would prevent the 13-year-old girl from being able to do anything about the end product of that rape? Moving along. Tough day for Pope Frank. The Italian weekly magazine L'Espresso, dropping the dime on a prince of the church by the name of Battista Ricca. He served at the Vatican Embassy in Montevideo in Uruguay. And while he was in Uruguay, let's say he had a gay old time. At least he wasn't doing children. No, this was just a gay guy. Not a pedophile, which has nothing to do with sexuality and everything to do with, right. He had a number of relationships while he was at the Vatican Embassy in Montevideo. And then eventually what the straw that broke the camel's back was an affair he had with one of the Swiss guards. That's when he got sent home to Rome. But getting sent home to Rome, and according to L'Espresso, he was sent home to Rome in disgrace. But getting sent home to Rome is not always so disgraceful. Sometimes, after you've been sent home to Rome, you get a nice new job. Pope Frank gave him a cozy little position at the Vatican Bank. Jesus. He's also been the director of the Santa Marta residence where Pope Frank lives. Federico Lombardi, who's a spokesman for the Vatican, says, it's not true. These allegations are not credible. On the other hand, L'Espresso says that numerous bishops, priests, religious, and laity in Uruguay have said, yeah, it happened. To the point that he was providing a little love shack for Swiss Guard Captain Patrick Hari back in 1999. And this is the pathetic part of it. One evening after he'd been out clubbing from one joint to another, or hangouts, as the translation goes, he was left badly beaten. I don't know. I wonder if this guy is following Pope Frank on Twitter. That'll get 7 years knocked off of his purgatory, you know. Jeez. Yeah, Marty, I wish you weren't right, but yeah. Marty says, I'm waiting for the right-wing nut jobs to start referring to the 13-year-old Texas rape victim as, and I'm not even going to use the word, well, to start smearing her and, you know, slut-shaming. Don't you hate it when you find yourself coming to those realizations? And don't you hate it even worse when they turn out to be true? Because, well, they do so often. And, you know, we had our prayer meeting Wednesday. But we just can't keep up with it. It's too much. News also breaking today that Hobby Lobby. Do you go to Hobby Lobby? Do you get your craft supplies at Hobby Lobby? Yeah, you might want to stop. This is the outfit that's run by committed Bible-believing Christians who feel like there's somehow Jesus won't like them if women are able to buy be provided birth control pills. You know, Jesus will, you know, just roast them over the flames of hell like a little marshmallow. A federal judge temporarily exempted Hobby Lobby stores from a requirement in the 2010 health care law that it offer workers insurance coverage for birth control, which the retailer said violated its religious beliefs. Since when can a company have religious beliefs? Beats me. The case has been continued by U.S. District Judge Joe Heaton in Oklahoma stand. It's been continued till October 1st with the preliminary injunction in place so that the federal government can decide whether or not it wants to appeal. Judge Heaton writing, there's a substantial public interest in ensuring that no individual or corporation, because corporations are people, right, has their legs cut out from under them while these difficult issues are resolved. I will not scream. Yeah, don't you love the imagery? Simply asking a corporation to follow the laws of the land is the same as cutting their legs out from under them. Does this rotten old Article 3 judge have any clue that there are people out there who really, really are challenged in their ability to get around because they've lost legs? But no. A bunch of millionaire Beatties, the Green family, who say that contraceptives like the morning after pill violate their Christian beliefs. Well, they're having it would cut their legs out from under them. Miserable. They're being represented in court by the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. They're not even having to pay for the lawyers because a non-profit is doing the lawyering for a for-profit company. In the court's words, Hobby Lobby drawn a line at providing coverage for drugs or devices they consider to induce abortions, even though they don't. Scientifically, medically, they don't induce abortions. But Hobby Lobby and the Green family, who bailed out Oral Roberts University, you might recall. The Green family considers that birth control pills and the morning after pill, that they induce abortions. They don't even have to be factually accurate. You see, this is just another one of those moments where we understand the truth of what I've said. The First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States exists primarily now in 2013 only as a life support system for the religion industry, in which one need not even prove that these substances do what they assert they do. They just get to believe it. Well, God said it, I believe it, and that settles it. Amen. Hallelujah. Beth, answering my non-rhetorical question, what's the difference between the rapists of the 13-year-old little girl and the Texas the men of the and Luckenbach Barbie of the Texas legislature? Beth says, when women's and girls' rights and lives are devalued by their government, it is inevitable that they be devalued by their wider culture. If the state does not honor or even recognize a woman's sovereignty over her own body, why should its citizens, especially the males whose rights are expanded by default under such a policy, precisely? One flows from the other as surely as heat comes from fire or smoke comes from, right, you get the idea. And this is a culture that a whole bunch of right-wingers in Texas want, and for which women and the people who love them are struggling to stop. Kevin in Colorado Springs went to the Settlement Home website. He said, Bob, I checked out the Settlement Home for Children homepage. Interesting spa day they must have had today. Amazing they still had this on the website, considering the story about the 13-year-old occurred just yesterday, according to the AP. And then, just to sort of close things out for the week, a fracking update. This comes via Truthout over at truthout.org. It is an interview. It's an interview with a man named Lewis W. Alstott. When he retired from Mobil, he was an executive vice president in charge of the company's exploration and production operations in the entire Western Hemisphere. He retired in 2000. He'd been with the company for 31 years, since 1969. He'd run marketing and refining operations in Japan. He'd managed worldwide supply trading and transportation. And he was integral to the merger between Mobil and Exxon that gave us the world's single largest corporation. Well, he did. He retired in 2000. And having retired, he sought to do that which many people retire do. And this guy wasn't exactly retiring on, say, the pension of a former public worker in Detroit. I mean, he wasn't retiring poor from ExxonMobil. So he moved. He moved to the Cooperstown, New York area, where he thought he was just going to enjoy his retirement, He and his wife opened up an art gallery. He started working on pottery, learned how to kayak, started teaching other people there to how to kayak around Lake Otsego. Lake Otsego is the lake where Cooperstown, New York, the home of the Baseball Hall of Fame, is nestled. The village of Cooperstown draws its drinking water out of Lake Otsego. And then everything started falling apart. Now, this is a guy who knew just about, as of 2000, knew just about everything about the oil and gas business that there was to know. And he wasn't running around telling, you know what, back when I was a highfalutin, high-flying mover and shaker in the oil, he didn't do that. When he talked about kayaking and the wonderful world of pottery and whether one was better off throwing one's pot on a mechanically operated, the electrically powered potter's wheel, or whether there was a greater degree of authenticity if one was sitting there working the treadle to make the wheel spin. But a few people, I guess, knew, according to this article, knew what he had done, so they started asking him questions. And they were asking him questions about so-called fracking. So he went off and read a 1,500-page report generated by the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation called the Supplemental Generic Environmental Impact Statement. I don't know about you, but the idea of a generic environmental impact statement seems rather pointless. The SGEIS. But even though it was generic, there was enough information in there to become quite bothersome to Mr. Ahlstadt. Because it turned out that there, within a stone's throw of the shores of Lake Otsego, where people get their water in Cooperstown and people of nice means retire and build themselves little cottages in which to enjoy their retirement. And it's a very touristy, pretty little place. Well, lo and behold, and damned if some natural gas company hadn't decided to come there and start fracking within a stone's throw of Lake Otsego. And Lewis W. Ahlstadt became concerned. He starts out in the interview, which is very well done over at truthout.org by Ellen Cantero. He starts out by describing the old oil and gas industry and says, well, those days are gone. Now what's happened is that the prospect of finding more of those conventional reservoirs, particularly on land and in the places that have been heavily explored like the U.S. and Europe and the Middle East, well, it's just very, very small. And the companies have pretty much acknowledged that. All of them talk about the need to go to either non-conventional shale or tight sand drilling, or to go into deeper and deeper waters, or to go into really hostile Arctic regions and possibly Antarctic regions. Well, that should fill you with a sense of dread. And he describes, and I really recommend that you read this over at truthout.org, he describes methane migration, which appeared in that original supplemental generic environmental impact statement originally. In the draft of it, there was a discussion of free-range methane, for lack of a better term. And he talks about the fact that even though a well can play out and get capped, that the methane will still find its way upward. And he points out that the only, was there any major turning point that started you thinking about methane migration? And he said there were many. An example is that one of the appendices of the draft SGEIS that was issued in July 2011 had a section describing an EPA study of the only cases where similar fractures had been unearthed. These were in a coal mining area. Gee, I wonder where. The EPA investigation indicated that the fractures had progressed in unexpected patterns and at greater lengths than expected. In September, when the draft SGEIS was eventually put out for comment, that section had been expunged. It had been disappeared, thrown down the memory well. It's no longer a memory hole, it's just a memory, yeah. And he says, to ignore the only direct evidence of fractures or to remove it from public information indicates that the industry was trying to hide something. He goes on, and he's quite forthright. He says, back in the 90s, we were starting to think a little bit about climate change, but nobody was paying much attention to it, and people were skeptical about it. And he talks about being in charge of the U.S. and Latin America oil production, yada, yada, yada. And it's thrown out there just kind of casually, but within, you know, within that statement, good God, can you imagine the abuses that took place in places like Venezuela or off the Mexican coast? The human cost of all of that stuff? Mostly, were you in charge of exploration? Mostly production. There wasn't a whole lot of exploration going on there. And then he retired. And this is the point where I become a little bit conflicted. On the one hand, I'm glad that there's somebody out there who comes from the industry who is actually being quite honest and saying this is something to be very, very concerned about, and the methane release is really, really scary because it does massively more harm to the atmosphere and adds to the carbon burden than, you know, other stuff. He said, initially I put together a little presentation. People started asking me if I would talk about it. It just happens that there were a few people within a couple of miles of here that knew something about it. We had different approaches, different styles, but we would share information. I ended up giving presentations to many towns around upstate New York. Sometimes this was on my own or in a small group. Sometimes it was part of panel discussions with people from both sides of the fracking debate. He said a Canadian drilling company started doing some seismic testing in the town of Middlefield. When the seismic event took place, it spurred a grassroots anti-fracking group to form almost overnight. It was mostly women, and you know these things often are, because women have the common sense enough to realize that this directly affects the ability to sustain life. And for some reason or other, men can be diverted by things like, oh, look, money. Once a month we'd get together. There were some pro-drillers in it, some anti. When it came to the town meetings, the town halls hardly ever had anybody come unless they needed a stop sign or some issue like that. Then all of a sudden I was standing room only, and it just kind of kept building. And he's very forthright, and he talks about, again, go read this at Truth Out. Former Mobil VP warns of fracking and climate change. Go read it. He's very forthright about it, and you get a sense that he really is concerned, and he's trying to do what he can. And yet I feel a sense of conflict about this. Because you know what? The conventional oil and the conventional gas that he was pumping during his career at Mobil was contributing to climate change as well. And God knows there had to be human rights violations out the gazoo if it was happening in the global south of this hemisphere. And he goes to retire in a beautiful little quaint town far away from the madding crowd, and suddenly the externalities of the oil and gas business impact him. And he gets involved, and I guess, you know, sometimes that's just how it happens, and you have to be thankful that somebody does get involved and that somebody does raise their voice. But is that how it always has to happen? Does it always have to be a matter of, I don't give a damn about it until it affects my narrow little world? because if it does, we're effed. If somebody has to be poisoned in New Mexico in order to care about people being poisoned in Appalachia, we're effed. Let's think about this. You can email over this, or we'll Facebook, or tweet over it, or whatever. I think it really is worth considering. And I thank you all. I thank you all for joining us this evening. When did I tweet something about a Bob and Mike peanut gallery? I don't think that was me, guys, in the chat room. But thanks, everybody, for joining in. I appreciate it. And, hey, we only pulled up $85 short for tonight's fundraising, or for the week's fundraising. So that means, let's see, that means $235 to raise on Monday evening, or between now and then. Thank you, everyone. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to everybody who makes all this happen. You, first and foremost, who share your finite, precious time to engage in this conversation, this discussion, this dialogue, this little confab on the front porch. Thank you. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to Sparky and Lottie, Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox in Australia. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACHE, ACT, ACHEACT.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy. And it didn't work. Well, it's still all for you. And y'all have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. Bye now.